I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. Very few child stars make the transition to full-blown adult stars. With the rigors of the life of an actor and the precarious, awkward teen years, most child stars burn out, get out, or fade out. You can't always tell who's going to make the leap, and even people who try don't always find their place as an adult star on the same scale as when they were children. Kirsten Dunst is one of the few who not only was a huge child star, but she's arguably an even bigger star as an adult. On top of that, I feel like she's transitioned from the ingenue lead into a delightful character actress in shows like On Becoming a God in Central Florida, which left us far too soon. 1999 and 2000 were both banner years for Kirsten, as well as placing her into the company of a group of young women who starred in dozens of ensemble teen movies together, but we don't for some reason have a cute name for, like the Brat Pack. The Millennial Mob? I'm going to work on it. Cam, Alicia, what was up with Kirsten Dunst in those 2 years? Because it's wild, the iconic movie she was in at that time.
She just made great choices. When you say that, you know, she's a really important character actress, I would argue at this point, because she is in production and she's really leading the way in a lot of shows, like her character on Fargo, which was season two, which was a real turning point for her, I think, where we were reminded of her greatness, that she's been this great since, like, what was she, 11 years old in Interview with the Vampire, 10 years old? Yep. I can't remember. Very young. I love that we're in this, like, Kirsten Dunst renaissance, and it's deserved because I think she's fantastic. And if you're talking about those 2 years of, like, 98, 99, 2000, holy moly, like, dick.
Yeah.
Obviously, Bring It On, which we're going to talk about, which is 2000. My favorite is Drop Dead Gorgeous. She is,
yeah, I'm there with you.
1999, unbelievable in that. She's such a natural comedian and such a natural leader. Like, she's just effervescent.
She's holding her own next to Christy Alley, Allison Janney, Ellen Burstyn, and she is, like, right there matching these,
Ellen,
like, legends of comedy beat for beat. Ellen Barkin, thank you, Ellen Barkin, matching them all beat for beat. It's wild.
Yeah, and dominating. Yeah, she's such a, she can be a background character, which she really was because she was such a huge star, and still just, like, steal the show. So I'm so happy to see that Kirsten Dunst is, like, very much behind the scenes and still in front of the camera in notable productions, especially around television today.
I mean, yeah, she's just an interesting person. But I also think that, I mean, it's like anyone's career. I think when somebody chooses to do more interesting projects, the dumb stuff falls away too. You know, like, I even think now people might forget that, like, Spider-Man was such a big part of her career.
About that.
You know? Or like Jumanji, you know, she was around doing dumb stuff. Small Soldiers coming soon on Hollywood Suite.
She did star in a Peter Bogdanovich film called Cat's Meow, where she played my icon Marion Davies, and that probably ingratiated her to me for the rest of, like, my life.
Sure.
That was, like, in the late 90s, I think, possibly early 2000s.
Yeah, and I think you shared, Becky, the interview that was kind of crazy, where from Interview Magazine, which is mostly coming off Virgin Suicides, and they're like, oh, that was such a great movie. But they get her to describe her projects, and her projects, she treats them all equally. And one is like a straight-to-video Edward Furlong version of The Crow, and one is like an indie movie none of us have ever heard of, and then one of them is Bring It On, which she's like, yeah, that's a fine movie, and it's like, oh.
Oh, guess which one people...
She did not realize what was the big one, basically.
Guess what people are going to be talking about 25 years later, but no one knew that Bring It On was going to be the mega hit that it was, right? Even the studios.
No. And a lot of hers are also, the interesting thing, which I guess, I mean, I'll get into now, is there's this weird thing in the early 2000s where movie studios were freaking out. We didn't get into it much in the show, but, like, essentially movie attendance was stagnating, which kind of makes sense. Like, it just had reached its peak. And other than, like, The Phantom Menace, people were kind of freaking out and like, what do we do? So then it really became all about DVD sales. And I think a lot of these Kirsten Dunst movies are huge on DVD. So something like Dick, which we've talked about before, was like a total failure at the box office. And then DVD was huge. And even Bring It On is like, did okay, but was really a huge DVD hit. And that's like Universal was just printing DVDs like maniacs and making all those sequels. So yeah, I think that a lot of her, until something like Spider-Man, though 99, she has a couple of huge hits, doesn't she? Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Which is kind of closer to 2000, depending on how you look at its release. So it's theoretically the same year as Bring It On, based on its theatrical release. But I mean, it made her like a darling on the film festival circuit. And it made her, you know, that's such an important relationship between Sofia Coppola and Kirsten Dunst.
And she was a big enough star too that her not being in one movie launched the stardom of Scarlett Johansson for not being in Lost in Translation, because that was supposed to be her.
And I also think, like, it's worth saying that I think even in 1994 she was considered to have been snubbed for the Oscar nomination.
I'm like, she got nominated for this, didn't she? And she didn't, which is weird.
Yeah, I thought she did too. Yeah, but I think it was considered, even though it was a child actor, I think that was considered a big
snub. I was obsessed with her.
Because that was such a great performance.
Like, from that film, I was obsessed with Kirsten Dunst. Like, I was someone who would want to read about her in 94, 95. I think we are almost the exact same age. I can't remember which year she's born, but she's probably the only person I can think of that was my age as a contemporary that I respected as an artist, like another 12-year-old respecting a fellow 12-year-old.
See, and that's interesting that you say that, because I actually, as a teenager, didn't like her and didn't see a lot of her movies until later, including Bring It On, because I found her too mainstream, not having seen Virgin Suicide, not having access to those films. I was like, oh, she's a bubbly blonde, whatever, and she's just going to fade away like everybody else. And now, coming to her as an adult, I'm like, no, she's amazing. Like, she really does have this incredible biting sense of humor.
Yeah, don't sleep on
Kirsten. I think you're right.
But
I think you're right. There are early in her career as many her just being a regular, leading lady, in the Crazy Beautiful or like Mona Lisa Smile, or
which that title alone, I'm sorry.
You know what was a real turning point for her? My memory's totally jogged. My little like Kirsten Dunst fan club membership card is like, getting its usage now. But it was a huge turning point for her. She had a really interesting breakout role in ER. Like, when ER is at the top, like number one show in North America, she played a child prostitute. And this would have been like, I want to say like 96, because she's slightly older than Interview. But that was like I feel like she maybe was even nominated for an Emmy. And I think that's really where a lot of maybe auteurist directors or indie directors are like, good God, look at this girl. Role is seared into my mind, actually. I haven't thought about that in 20 years, probably.
Interesting. Okay. Well, it's now all available to watch, so you can go back and see all your favorite cameos. All right. Let's get to our first movie today, because I want to love Bring It On. I really, really do. And I feel like maybe if I had seen it as a teen, I may have the vehement nostalgia defense of it that's in so many retrospective articles that I've been reading for this podcast. People love this movie. But it's one of those movies that I would really love to have a look at the original script of and perhaps see that version made one day. However, with a franchise containing 6 movies, 5 of which are direct-to-video, my favorite title of which being Bring It On Worldwide Cheer Smack, a Broadway musical in part penned by Lin-Manuel Miranda, and an upcoming Halloween special made for TV, unfortunately, a faithful to the original screenplay reboot does not seem likely, minus perhaps some of the bizarro made-up blaxploitation language that it supposedly contained. We're going to talk about that. So I will have to love what I can in this movie, like the fantastic performances, of course, Kirsten Dunst, Gabrielle Union, and Eliza Dushku, and the frankly impressive dance sequences and stunts, and an incredibly progressive message about cultural appropriation and female leadership. I could be wrong. Ebert called it the Citizen Kane of cheerleader movies, although that was years after giving it 2 out of 4 stars. So maybe it will grow on me. Cam, do you have strong feelings about Bring It On? Is this something that you were very into?
I mean, I think I agree that the weird thing is that it has such a wildly like interesting and nuanced message. The fact that it's not really that much of a competition movie, the fact that it's not really much of a teen romance, but it's this weird kind of like exploration of your own purpose and stuff. Because yeah, I mean, you can, the plot has a million threads, it's rife with incident, but really the plot of the film is that Kirsten Dunst's character Torrance inherits this cheerleading team, and it's the most important thing to her. She's not very good at school, and she knows that this is kind of her future, and then she pretty immediately finds out that the cheer team has, it's like a five-time national champion, and they've been stealing all their routines from a local Compton squad. And then it's kind of up to her to grapple with either the like moral justification of continuing to steal these routines, or trying to create their own routine and realizing that they've always been creatively bankrupt and don't really know how to do that. And then I think also just exploring kind of the general structure of cheerleading, because they're obviously eventually, you know, the Compton Clovers can't afford to go to the championship, and they are afforded an automatic spot even though they did all this illegal stuff, and they do another illegal thing later. So yeah, it's interesting. It reminds me a lot, weirdly, of Saturday Night Fever, and the part of Saturday Night Fever that people don't remember, which is the fact that like John Travolta has this big realization that the Latino dancers are better than him, but he still wins the competition. And he's, that's what makes him realize he's a rapist and be disillusioned on all life at the end of the movie. Yeah. And I find that that's kind of the same thing. Like, it's in the end, the movie is not about winning this competition at all. It's just about like having any dignity in what you're doing. Because yeah, she just gets everything taken away from her, essentially.
It's a lot about white privilege. I mean, this is also when you're saying Gabrielle Union's cheerleading squad is in Compton, Torrance's, the Toros, go to Rancho Carne, which translates to meat ranch high school in San Diego. So like, as much as like, you know, the difference, as someone who grew up in like Southern California, like the difference between like Compton and San Diego is vast, vast, even like distance wise, but also just
They're quite far apart.
Yeah, it's hours.
That's the
it's
one thing this movie kind of makes up.
It's like hours drive. It'd be like saying that, you know, oh, I don't know, like Prince Edward County or Kingston is a suburb of Toronto, which it's not, but probably people outside of Ontario think that. So it is a lot about white privilege and, you know, the difference between living in central Los Angeles and San Diego and what that would mean.
Now, from my understanding, in the original script, there was actually more time spent with Gabrielle Union's team that was bigger. She had a boyfriend. You got to see more of their day-to-day life versus them just sort of popping up as kind of antagonists, but not really to the Toros. Like, it was more of like a half and half film, whereas now, the current one very much focuses on Torrance and the Toros.
And I get there's like, there's also talk of a script that I think is kind of interesting, that they talk as like a fight between internally in the white school between the dance team and the cheer team, which I feel like it's worth saying before we also get too deep into this, Alicia, just to catch you up. Becky and I went to an internationally famous cheerleading school. It is worth saying. World champions.
So we literally had to import our football players from other schools because we did not have enough people that wanted to play football, but we had a team.
A mixed football team. Yeah, we went to the school from Glee, basically, that had a world famous cheer team and a musical theater / theater.
It's a very big thing.
They were world champions. They performed a move that was eventually deemed illegal because other teams couldn't figure out how to do it safely.
I am gobsmacked. It was like a, this is parts of Becky and Cam's biography did not know.
Also, the Edmonton Eskimos cheerleaders are, I mean, Edmonton Elks.
That's right.
Cheerleaders are very.
Well, I mean, maybe I should catch you both up, but I went to a very underperforming high school, like the worst high school in the town that I went to high school in, with probably some of the worst cheerleaders.
But they loved it. I'm sure they loved
it. Fair enough. But yeah, anyway, it's just to know that there's like, usually there is this big divide between the kind of cheering, the words that is the start of this movie, and then the dance, which is like the real national competitions. So yeah, it was kind of, there are interesting previous scripts and I'm kind of interested, but I also get the weird thing is like, I kind of, you hear sometimes Gabrielle Union talk about like, I think that she sees her character as like maybe the more interesting story. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing is, I disagree because they're good. They're always good. And the only conflict they have is they briefly don't have money. So it's like, that is actually not, there's not much conflict in that story.
But I think that's also because all the conflict that could be there in a more complex thing. Like, for example, she used to have a boyfriend who at some point was like, this is a waste of your time making those assumptions, I think is really interesting. There's a lot more in there about someone who possibly does not have great upbringing. I mean, it's just a different film when you focus on the two, right?
Yeah, but I also think, I don't know, it just seems weird. weird to me that it seems like by the time people were making it, it was not that film. That script seems long, way before. So I don't know.
There's a fantastic interview with Gabrielle Union in Vogue that I think we all read, where she's talking about some of the original language that was in this. It was very like, sorry, mm-hmm. what? Like this kitty cat has claws and she's going to scratch your eyes out, like
it's
something like
terrible,
that. But done in like
off-brand black exploitation written by a white person.
It does seem though. Also, part of the development of the script was they got all of the kids to rewrite the dialogue. I think it seems especially egregious because it was obviously white people writing black people. Though she also said that a black writer took a pass on the script. So I don't know. But he talks about, because I mean, one thing we'll probably bring up is the fact that there's a lot of like slurs in this movie. It'll definitely seem, because it's, you know, it's 22 years old-ish. So you'll be like shocked. But part of it is Peyton Reed said he got the kids to say, like, what do people actually say to each other? Yeah. And he thought that it was important that, like, you know, that a male cheerleader would get the F slur thrown at him.
Yeah, it's names that we call each other in high school that's... 22 years ago. Yeah. It's very accurate in its representation of how horrible we all were to each other. I shouldn't say everyone, but, like, mm-hmm. this was the kind of, you know, cultural currency was just, like, dropping these names.
We're still talking about that today, though. I mean, Matt Damon's currently embroiled in exactly that,
oh
right?
I didn't know this. I don't want to know this. I'll look it up later.
Fine. Oh no, it's fine. He's just dumb.
He's a dum dum.
he was telling on himself. Yeah, it's not great. But but anyway, it's interesting, and I do think because I mean, there's more than that. There's the R word. There's everything.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, it's interesting because there's a great interview with Peyton Reed in The Advocate where he's like, oh, yeah, this is not just whatever. It was like we very intentionally were like, yeah, well, it's important to show that.
Let's talk about Peyton Reed, actually, just for a moment, because he's a filmmaker who maybe a lot of people don't maybe recognize his name. But I mean, he does all the Ant-Man movies, including Ant-Man and Wasp. Yeah. He's doing the new upcoming one. And when you look at his filmography, you're like, OK, like it's Jim Carrey's Yes Men, his thing like that. There's no question. Mm. Bring It On got him those movies because the choreography and the way the choreography is shot in this film is easily the best part of it. It's stunning. All of these cheerleaders, all these actors went to boot camp to learn how to do all of this stuff. From my understand, the Toro team got 9 weeks of stuff, and then the Compton cheerleaders, the Clovers, got 2 weeks. And that's also because they had actual cheerleaders they had recruited to be on that team, so they didn't need it
much. That team is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. So and so when you see what they did, and they needed actual cheerleaders to be able to do what
there's
they're
no
doing
stunt
because
doubles,
it's just
which
wild.
Is baffling. No. And it's mostly because they couldn't afford them. Like this made $90 million at the box office on like a $10 million budget. That's just the initial box office. It's made substantially more since
it's basically like an indie movie, which is kind of interesting because you don't really think that with Gabrielle Union and Kirsten Dunst. But it's like, no, it's basically. And I mean, they say that a lot of what makes it special is the fact that they had essentially no oversight. Mm-hmm. It was a movie that they just kind of were. They're like, we're in San Diego. Nobody's paying attention to us. And I think it's like it's distributed by Universal, but it was made just by like Beacon or something.
Yeah, I think Universal would have snapped it up after seeing like a rough cut.
Yeah.
I don't think they had any production.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, and then, you know, it was a good, I mean, such a bankroll for them because then they could make that many sequels, TV shows. Like, it's become a franchise. It's really remarkable.
Oh, yeah. And I think the thing that's weird is Peyton Reed doesn't have a lot of, like, it's a little hard to be like, what's his auteur thing? But he's one of the rare people that's, like, from Disney Channel who went on, I think, a lot like the guy who did High School Musical and stuff. And I think a lot of what he brings is actually, like, just colorful, like, positive filmmaking, because that's like he also worked on like the Weird Al show, which I feel like seems are like a real Peyton Reed thing, and the Upright Citizens Brigade, which Ian Roberts is in this movie because of that. It's interesting. The thing, like, I mean, a lot of people know Down with Love, which I feel like is a pretty good like auteur idea of what he kind of likes to do. And interestingly, he's a guy who was tied up with Marvel forever because he famously has this treatment that everybody wanted and never came to pass for the Fantastic Four that was set in the 1960s and inspired by like Beatlemania.
That's because they can never make a good Fantastic Four movie,
I know,
or else the world
but they're
will
like,
end.
What could have been? That I think predated even our 2000s Fantastic Four. So that was kind of like his interesting thing. But anyway, he's an interesting guy, but you're right. There's not much to it, but he's like kind of a comedy guy, kind of a colorful, exciting guy.
Is that why he plays the mime? And, so briefly, in this film, and the cheerleaders are thinking about using mime for inspiration, and then this is like silly mime that's on screen for 4 seconds, and it's, I had to read later that it was Peyton Reed doing a cameo.
I have to say, some of my favorite moments in this film, which I didn't totally understand why they were there, but they were my favorite moments, are the ones where it breaks out from the story and just shows you like a weird little vignette, like a cheer mom yelling at the judges. I think that moment's very funny. I love Claire Kramer yelling at a small child.
She beats her up. She pushes her. It's like a six-year-old cheerleader in line in front of her, and you think she's beating up another cheerleader. I shouldn't say beating up. She's like pushing her really roughly, and the little girl turns around. She's like six, and she like gives as much sass as she's getting. It's pretty great.
Yeah, actually, you get, because I know that this was originally developed, Jessica Bentinger did it as a documentary about the National Cheer Championships, and she kind of pitched it to ESPN and stuff, and it didn't go, and then she's like, well, I'll just do a fictional treatment. So I think, it's weird, when they get to that competition, there's some really great stuff. And also the other thing to know, which comes up quite a bit in a lot of the oral histories here, is this was coming out and being in production essentially the same time as a much forgotten and worse movie that was the one I liked, Sugar and Spice, which is about cheerleaders robbing a bank. So I think that I wonder if sometimes this movie was kind of nudged more in the positive teen movie direction because they knew Sugar and Spice was like an R-rated Marley Shelton.
Who I think was going to be, before it was Kirsten Dunst in this film, it was going to be Marley Shelton. Hmm. And she decided to do Sugar and Spice instead. Whereas Gabrielle Union had auditioned for, I don't know if it was the lead role. I don't think it was Marley Shelton's, but it was one of the bank robbing cheerleader roles. And she was literally told, we don't see this film having a role for a person of color.
I think it's that they didn't want to have a black person. They didn't want the like implications of a black cheerleader being
involved.
But
it does
in, like,
remind me, Becky, of when we were talking about just a few episodes ago, But I'm a Cheerleader, where the role that would eventually go to Natasha Lyonne was actually written for Rosario Dawson. And the studio was like, we don't want a person of color as a cheerleader in this film.
Which is just wild. I don't know. I think there's the other thing that I really want to I want to talk about in this, that I think watching it as an adult, more so than the very dated, inappropriate slang, is I think people forget in the late 90s, 2000s, how big Girls Gone Wild was and how mainstream it was. Like, this was a softcore and sometimes hardcore pornography direct-to-video series that made someone who eventually went to jail for exactly what you think. He made him very rich, but like Brad Pitt, Justin Timberlake, these people were wearing like branded material from that out in public, being photographed with these with Girls Gone Wild t-shirts and hats. And it's nowhere more apparent for me than in that car wash sequence. That I found that car wash sequence so reprehensible, and it was something that made me kind of go, who is this movie for? Because it's very much marketed towards young teen girls, but the sexualization of these young women who are meant to be 15, 16, 17, including by an announcer who starts talking about how hot they are in their short skirts, who's clearly a man in his like mid-40s, 50s, is like, why are you calling attention to that? Like, that's very weird to me.
Do you think it's calling attention, or do you think it's part of the elements of satire? Potentially.
I don't know.
I think that for me, the announcer is just showing how gross ESPN is.
Yeah, I think that's satire for sure.
The other thing is, I'm surprised that you say a bikini car wash is reprehensible, because like those
I know they do.
In our high school all the time.
Okay, the way it's shot, where it's being shot like a Girls Gone Wild video.
That's how the videos that like were, you know, the early videography of our high school parties, that's what they looked on. It was close-ups on
boobs. It doesn't mean I have to like it.
No, I'm not saying you don't have to like it.
Yeah, but I just think reprehensible.
I'm going with
is
reprehensible.
A wild, Becky.
I want to hope that Peyton.
Sure. You know that teens have sex.
No, they don't.
It's a thing that happens.
I want to hope that Peyton Reed is smarter. I think Peyton Reed's smarter and more finger on the pulse than maybe he could be seen as in this sequence. Like, I do think he's kind of showing just how sexualized high school is, just how sexualized cheerleading is, even though these are, you know, profoundly talented athletes. Like, a lot of the athletes, a lot of the girls in both teams were like, you know, I did gymnastics, I did this sport, I did this sport. I was not prepared for how hard cheerleading is. I'm hoping that that's a moment of levity where he's kind of showing the flip side of, or like how we all view cheerleaders, whereas what the reality is.
And
is
I
the
think
story
it's also worth
film.
the most of the point of that scene is both that Jesse Bradford comes to it kind of to ogle Kirsten Dunst and then immediately gets trolled by his own sister, who he never thought would do it. And she's just like parading in front of him to bother him. And then she also essentially goes like, hey, my brother's here to look at your boobs.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Kirsten Dunst's bathing suit isn't that revealing in this sequence.
Yes.
There is a hierarchy of who's wearing she's wearing little boy shorts and it's adorable.
It's like the Lisa one where there's like, there's a star on the fanny. I don't know. I think that there's something to that. And like the whole end of the joke is that like Jesse Bradford's like, I wish I had a brother. And she's like, your brother would be making a lot less money at this car.
Yeah, I think lines like, not to disagree with you, Becky, but maybe that gives a little
but you're disagreeing with me.
This film opens with a dream sequence, which my understanding, and I have to admit, I've never seen any of the sequels, of which there are many. They all open with a dream sequence of some sort of like a cheer gone wrong. Okay. It's like something that
except for one of them.
It's something that they've stuck to as part of the narrative, signature part of the narrative. But this opens with like a cheer, and the cheer uses terms like whore and slut, and I was just like, what the hell? And then you realize she's woken up from a dream where she is completely topless and naked. All of a sudden, like her like cheerleading outfit has fallen off her during a stunt, and the whole like basketball court can see her naked. I feel like, you know, right from the very beginning, if that's how you open your film, then you're playing a little bit with fire in terms of how we sexualize young girls. But I think Peyton Reed knows that it's wrong. I think
it sits just so on the line for me where I don't think it's in the wrong side of satire for me. And I think that's the problem I have with it, is that like it could be really clever and a very interesting point of view on that. Yes, we are sexualizing these young women, but I think it sits too far too. No, we're sexualizing these young women and we're trying to get
teenagers. But I also feel like you have to keep in mind that this is up against like American Pie,
which I know, which is still least, we shouldn't
the
be
least
making
possible
American Pie.
No, but I mean, like in comparison, I don't think anyone at the time would have seen this as any sort of sex movie.
No, and I agree. I'm actually I'm there with you, and I think it's just looking back at these movies, which I do feel like this the Girls Gone Wild sort of attitude towards young women and the fact of the party and that it's fun and that kind of thing. Very much feeds into a lot of those things like American Pie. It's such a part of the culture at that time that I still don't think we've totally gotten out of.
I think if you turned on The Kissing Booth or something on Netflix,
what
you
is
might
The Kissing
be,
Booth?
Find it reprehensible. Just a teen movie.
At this moment, are you calling me a prude?
A little.
Okay.
I'm not going to call you a prude. Checking. I'm going to say this one thing, though. I do find it interesting, and I didn't know this, that you cannot show a midriff in national or even regional cheerleading competitions. Like, and I remember in my high school, they didn't, you know, it was not a very revealing, I mean, short skirt certainly, but not a super revealing, in comparison to this film, cheerleading uniform. Whereas, like, this film obviously knows that it has to put everyone in a crop top, and there's a lot of there's not necessarily up the skirt shots, but there is... Oh, God, can we talk about the one? There's like a character who's kind of somewhat labeled a lesbian, and then it turns out she's not, because one of the like the straight male cheerleaders talks about like feeling her up during one of the stunts. Yeah. That's a little bit like, oh God, like I get what you're saying, Becky. There are moments. I'm trying to not dislike this film, though.
I think it's just them trying to be realistic.
It's high school
scenes,
shit,
though. Like there's moments where guys are gross, and that's what a high school boy is like.
All right. Well, what I do want to say that I think is a positive thing about this, we've talked about these people as being athletes. And one of the things I think this really did for it was, if you're watching any of the original interviews with Gabrielle Union or Eliza Dushku or whoever, they are all very adamant about how impressed they are by the athleticism of it and really trying to sell this as a sport, which it is. Yeah. And I do think it did a lot to kind of push that sort of idea of they are really impressive athletes.
Yeah.
And that final sequence is, we're going to talk about in the next movie, I think one of the worst final sequences of all time.
I would agree with you for the next movie.
And this
it's
is an incredibly
people,
impressive.
It's for the people, Cam. It's ballet for the people. Are you not of the people?
But this one is like, this one actually, if anything, betrays the rest of the film by being so athletic. And the start of the film seems to be that the toros are stealing the clovers like literal chants.
Yeah. Agreed.
Rather than their choreography, because I think they don't trust the audience to understand stolen choreography. But then the final competition is just high-flying gymnastics and choreography in a way that you're like, oh, whoa, this is nuts.
Yeah, we learned the difference between spirit fingers and jazz hands. I do want to praise this film for its references to Sweet Charity, one of my favorite Bob Fosse musicals. It is super strange for a film that was made for teens to have a Sweet Charity reference in 2000.
That would have been a movie made for me, Alicia. Yeah. Also, yeah. I think the Sparky character is easily one of my favorite things. His like introduction, I think, is one of the funniest things ever.
What you do is a tiny, pathetic subset of dancing. I will attempt to transform your robotic routines into poetry written with the human body. Follow me or perish, sweater monkeys.
Oh, yeah. And I love that they're like, I love number one that Peyton Reed and Jessica Bendinger are like still friends. And number two, they're like, when are we going to make a Better Call Saul about Sparky Pulaski?
Oh my God.
Yes! And it's like, yes. Why isn't Netflix listening to this right now? And they still talk about, they're like, they, the two of them, would like to do some sort of Bring It On 20 years later sequel, which is kind of fascinating. And they might be able to do something interesting with
it. I want to see like Kirsten Dunst's character, Torrance, because there's a certain point where someone's telling her, you know, cheerleading is not that important. Like, you're such a lovely person. You have other things. And her response is, no, all I am, not all I have, all I am is cheerleading. And I'd love to see, you know, how much leadership she brings to this film as a character. I'd love to see her, like, be a Hollywood producer 20 years later, or, like, someone who's, like, revolutionized cheerleading. Because I see that in her character. And that'd be nice, you know, that would be a nice follow-up.
And it's also just wild to think they all seem to like it. Like, I mean, you see these reunions and stuff where they all seem to be friendly with one another. And and it'd just be weird to think of like the careers of Gabrielle Union, Eliza Dushku, and Kirsten Dunst 20 years later. They're quite different people. Except for Eliza Dushku, who seems to be herself IRL.
There's a great Instagram post. It was in the interview with Gabrielle Union where I guess it was like probably last year, the 20th anniversary, where for Halloween she dressed up she tried to borrow her original costume from Universal and they were like, hell no. So she had her stylist recreate it really quickly. But then the Instagram post, she has her little itty-bitty daughter dressed up as the cheerleader too, and it's just the cutest thing. And I think it like it's exploded on the internet, which is really a sign of how rabid the fandom is for this film. That first of all, Gabrielle Union still looks like she was 27 years old, which is how old she was in this film.
She's fucking 27 in this movie, which is mind-boggling.
Kirsten Dunst is 17. She's actually playing her age.
It's fascinating to see Gabrielle Union's, because she has pretty much the same, like we were saying, Kirsten Dunst had this big 99-2000. Gabrielle Union has absolutely the same thing. But Gabrielle Union's is all over the place because she's also starring as like a doctor on a TV show. And you're like, geez.
She's in Love and Basketball.
So Love and Basketball, she's like a high school student.
Yeah.
But then she's a doctor on this TV show. And also, that TV show was like, it's like her and Viola Davis. And you're like, this TV show didn't go? It's like Vivica A. Fox, Viola Davis, Blair Underwood.
What?
Gabrielle Union, Maya Rudolph. It's called City of Angels, I think, and it was like a hospital show.
Maya Rudolph, that's like pre-SNL.
Yeah, Maya Rudolph was the nurse. It's like created by Stephen Bochco. It's like, what is this show?
Is he the one that made Cop Rock?
Yeah, I mean,
that might have hurt us.
That might have been
where
Robert Morse. They've got Robert Morse for you, Alicia, from Mad Men / How to Get Ahead in Business. Yeah, anyway, it's just this crazy show that I'm like, this ran for one season, and it's got perhaps the future stacked cast that they didn't realize they had.
Okay, I think that's probably where we should head into our next film, which is going to feature Zoe Saldana. Talk about more wonderful Black actresses who would go on to do really cool stuff, being parts of huge, huge franchises. So when we come back, we're going to look at, of course, a ballet movie that tackles the strife of adolescent dancers at a prestigious academy. The commitment to realism extends to a minute and a half long montage of breaking in point shoes. It's Center Stage, coming up after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
When I was growing up and at Arts High School, in fact, as we mentioned, the same one Cam attended, I had a number of friends who were seeking careers as professional ballet dancers. And every single one of them had some sort of eating disorder, smoked like Howard the Duck billboards, and had feet battered beyond belief. But man, they love to dance, and they made it look so effortless. So although the movie Center Stage has a number of elements that are very fairy tale, a lot of the actual ballet dancer life is pretty bang on. This seems like an ultimate 2000s sleepover movies, solid dancing, relatable stereotype characters, attractive teenagers, and a non-threatening sex scene for extra titillation. And like Bring It On, Center Stage launched a bit of a franchise. There are two more films in the series, and a TV series is in development as of late 2020. Alicia, let's talk Center Stage and ballet movies in general, of which I know you have opinions.
I mean, my opinion is I love them very much. And I actually didn't grow up with Center Stage. This is my first time watching it. So it's kind of interesting coming to it, having really focused on any possible ballet film from the silent era to now. I'm obsessed with and watch a lot. The Red Shoes is definitely one of my all-time favorite films. So it's interesting coming to this film. The plot, there's not much of a plot. This is almost like, I mean, if I told you there's a film called Center Stage from the year 2000 that took place in New York, you could probably tell me what the plot is. It has, it's reminiscent of a film like Fame from 1980. So we have this very stunning, semi-talented, aspiring ballet dancer who auditions for the American Ballet Company, the ABC. This is a ballerina played by real-life ballerina Amanda Scholl. Her character's name is Jody Sawyer, and Jody Sawyer is definitely, the name is a reference to Peggy Sawyer's character in 42nd Street. So there's a lot of references in Center Stage to the dance films that came before it. She makes the company. There is a parallel sort of storyline that is Zoe Saldana's. And as you mentioned, Becky, this is a luminescent Zoe Saldana, who, while not a trained ballerina, did have dance experience. And in the film, to me, I'm not a dance expert, but I would have thought she was an absolute life-trained ballerina. She really can.
There's only two people here who are not trained ballerinas. Thing is actually full of
real
top-notch ballet dancers. Yeah, Zoe Saldana and then Susan May Pratt, who plays Maureen, who is the best dancer at the school. Who the hell are you? Which is interesting that all the shots that they do of her are just arms because she can't do the feet stuff to the same level everybody else is doing.
Yeah, true. And she is the only person of color in this dance school to have won a scholarship. As in the same way that we kind of talked about Bring It On, Center Stage has moments where it's discussing the lack of representation in American ballet, worldwide ballet in general, especially for Black women. But it never really hits it home as much as I wanted it to. So we get this character that Zoe Saldana plays, Eva, who is angry and doesn't fit in and is the rebel and, shows up late for class and is always kind of has these snide remarks. And it's widely remarked that she has this bad attitude. She's like the bad ballerina, but it's never really said why. And it's, we know why. I mean, obviously, she is at a huge disadvantage, both in her upbringing as a ballerina and at this company.
Saying use what you have and turn up.
Jesus, she heard you.
Excuse me?
She heard you. We all heard you. You don't have to speak to her like that. Anyone can see she's working her ass off.
That's enough, Miss Rodriguez.
The company itself, the ABC, is definitely in reference to the real company, which is the American Ballet Theater, which is, I think, 80 years old at this point. And a lot of the lead dancers, including most of the male characters in this film, were actual dancers from ABT. And some of them would even go on to become like the artistic directors of ABT. And I think as of like a couple years ago, we're still there. So it's really, if you know ABT and its history, this is like a film that really poached a lot of those performers and used them to a great extent. I mean, the dance sequences in this are incredible, except for I'm going to allow Cam in a little bit to talk about that. That, oh my God, that finale, which is utterly ridiculous. And the thing about Jodie's character, the lead blonde, is she's not very good. Like, she has the heart, kind of, but her technique isn't really there. They say she has bad feet. They bring up that she doesn't have the right body, which is insane watching this film. And she has to kind of find her own, you know, like, she does a couple like modern dance classes at what looks like the Y, although it's clearly not the Y. And she kind of finds her, like, I don't know, her funk, and that's what she brings.
She gets her groove.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, this is a very formulaic film. It's a fantasy. It's got elements of a fairy tale for sure. I'm much more interested in Eva's character, played by Zoe Saldana, which does luckily get this kind of fairy tale ending. But if you love ballet, I do think that this is the film for you. And I understand why this was so popular in my high school. I grew up doing ballet and then quit when I was 15, and then had no tolerance for ever watching anything to do with ballet until probably my early 30s. And so,
is that PTSD? Is that why?
I mean, I was never that good, and it was never to the extremes that you see in this film, where you see eating disorders. I love that you bring up the, you know, 10 minutes, like a full 2 minute montage of breaking in point shoes, which is absolutely something I remember, despite barely being in point shoes before I quit. You know, it really is a film made by someone who understood dance. And that makes sense when we think about this director who, you know, has been the artistic director of the London Theatre, like really new dance, new wide scale productions, and knew how to, I think, film them.
So interestingly, this is an Amy Pascal pet project. She commissioned this because she wanted a teen dance movie on their roster. And so she got the treatment for it. And like, it was very much curated to be exactly what you see, like stereotypes, very relatable, great dance, et cetera, et cetera. And Carol Heikkinen, I believe is how you pronounce her name. You look at her writing history, and she wrote Empire Records.
Yeah.
Right. So like, she understands, like, here's a group of different teens. Here's how you identify the rebel who was bald and, you know, the cool girl. And so like, she already had that kind of basis to it. It looks like the last movie she wrote and was like involved in the film industry. Nicholas Heitner is an interesting filmmaker. He got pulled in a lot because he does a ton of theater and a ton of Broadway, and does fancy movies like History Boys and Madison King
about
George.
The only non play adaptation he's ever done.
National Theater is like his big
his
one.
His pedigree,
like
his mother was like like, I think she's like a dame. Like, she's incredibly important as a philanthropist for British theater going back to like the 1940s or something like that. Like, he's born into this. He directed The Mad King George. Is that the title of the film?
Madness of King George.
I was surprised, really surprised when I looked at his filmography, because it's quite impressive. And I just, at first I was like, how did this guy get this project? But then after watching it with its allusions to 42nd Street and, you know, it's really a theatrical kind of tableau based film, makes
sense.
It's
very much shot like theater. Like, especially like, I think that's my one issue with the shooting of the ballet, is because ballet, like a play, is very theatrical, that it's hard to get in there and like really show what the experience is like because of how you're shooting it. Stop me if you think I'm wrong here.
I think you're right. And I think what this film pulls off really well is you can be a principal dancer and one of the most, you know, revered of stage performers, but it doesn't mean that's going to translate to film in terms of facial gestures, in terms of how you read on camera, in terms of your body proportions. What this film did really, really well is these are, you know, really exquisitely trained dancers who have been doing this all their young lives. Most of these people are very young, that look great in film, that could actually pull off, for the most part, you know, the dialogue when they're not dancing, the you know, yeah, very tame sex scene, the bar scene, yeah, where they're all getting too drunk, or, you know, it's interesting. I know Amanda Scholl, who plays the lead character, really talked about, she was so comfortable in the dance. She came from the San Francisco Ballet School. She was so comfortable with the dance stuff, but then, like, the scenes where she had to, like, tell off the guy who, like, stood her up, and she's not great. That's okay. No. It's a teen film. This is a teen film.
It's kind of weird who is great and who is not great, because I feel like, I mean, obviously, like you say, Susan May Pratt, I think that she also has the heaviest lifting as an actor. And she was a pretty known actor, if you look. She's like really the like third lead of every teen movie around this era.
Because I don't want to be a ballet dancer.
Yes, you do. You always have.
No, Mom. If this were what I wanted, I wouldn't be as unhappy as I've been, and I'd have friends, I'd sleep well, I wouldn't throw up half the things that I eat.
You watch your weight, there's nothing wrong with that.
God, don't you hear me? I'm telling you, I'm unhappy and sick. I can't do this anymore.
But weirdly, like, I think that Ilya Kulik is very good, yeah, the figure skater. I think Ethan Stiefel's pretty good as, like, the jackass.
He's huge in the dance.
He's just a ballet dancer. Yeah, like, he was the biggest ballet dancer in the cast. And I think he weirdly acts circles around the other male lead.
He really loves his own. He was a motorcycle enthusiast in real life. So, I mean, we are introduced to his character on a motorcycle. The motorcycle, I'm not going to, I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it, but Cam will talk about how important a motorcycle is for this finale.
What I also love is the fact that Ethan Stiefel, as well as Sasha Radetzky, who plays the, I believe I'm pronouncing his name right, both of their wives are also in this film, because they are they
future
are
wives.
Ballet
future wives.
Future wives, yes. Fiancés and then future
and
wives.
And those two in particular have known each other since they were six, is my understanding, because they had been dancing that long in the same school. So there's a real community here, a New York-based community of dancers, that I think that charisma and that sort of chemistry does play into. It True. Does come off to me, at least when I'm watching the film. It doesn't work entirely, but it's there.
That leap off is quite possibly one of my favorite things that we've watched all season. The leap off is delightful and seems like something two ballet dancers would come up with.
How would you compare it to the backflip off from
the flip off? Yeah,
I mean, that to me is the pinnacle.
They didn't do it outside of burger joints.
No one leaped over a convertible. So I don't know, Becky, that flying is always going to have my heart for that competition.
Because they're both actually doing it, which is what I think is so wonderful about it. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing, that there's a reference here that ended up getting missed, because originally the character played by Sasha is meant to be played by a Latino dancer. And they had three Latino dancers they were going to use. And they went with Angel Corella, who ended up injuring. Now, there's two things people say in any of the oral histories. One is that Angel hurt himself and was unable to do the film. The other is that he was spoken to about it, but they didn't decide to go with him. I'm going to quote this here by a producer. He said, it seemed to occur was a script issue that we all, including the studio, felt a kind of in the moment. It was more fun and cool to have a boy next door in the role. And I'm like, at what point is that ever more fun and cool? But it seems like having a Latino actor in that role makes it almost West Side Story-y.
I also think it might distract from the Zoe Saldana plot, to be honest, to have like multiple racial aspects. I also think it at some point, and they kind of talk about, I think, in some of the examinations of Zoe Saldana's character, is like it actually is maybe too fantasy-y of a diverse cast already, even with two like black and like mixed race people. I also thought it was quite interesting because, like, Zoe Saldana is Dominican, and this is, like, the one time you really see her play a Dominican woman, which is kind of interesting. I mean, she does now and again, but it's, I mean, Zoe Saldana also famously, she's like, all the good roles are science fiction, so she's so often an alien.
Which is fine. She is in three of the biggest franchises on the planet.
She can buy and sell me, so go off.
It's interesting because I was kind of looking at the history of black principal dancers up to today, because when this film was made in 2000, like something like ABT, which is the, you know, the theater it really takes place in, they didn't have a black principal dancer until 2015. It would take 15 years after this film for Misty Copeland to be the first African-American principal dancer in a U.S. Like dance company, in one of the leading dance companies. It's
the one, like the same article kind of saying that it was kind of unrealistic that she wins her role at the end, was saying that they were very lucky that there was a fairly high profile black dancer to double her. Right. Like, essentially, that if it was a different time, like, I think that they're saying if it was 2 or 3 years earlier, they would have struggled to find a professional black ballet dancer of the level they needed to double.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's only now that we're starting to see dance companies wake the fuck up and make tights and shoes that are black skin toned based. You know, prior to like 5, 6 years ago, they had to be custom made, or which would mean so much money. Like, dancing is, like we're talking about cheerleading, so expensive. And so the idea that you would have disadvantaged dancers then have to get everything they have custom made. They can't even go to the already insanely expensive dance supply stores. I mean, that's something that, you know, this film isn't really talking about at all. It has a black character, but it's not really looking at the, I wish it had a little bit more.
And she's the underprivileged one, but they kind of don't deal with the financial aspect at all.
They do mention she's on it's funny, in the bar scene where she's telling her friends that she got in, she does say, I think there's a nod that she has a full ride. So that explains why a black girl would be at this school when she clearly can't afford it.
Yeah, I think that they also weirdly have her shrug off. It's not that she has a chip on her shoulder. It's also that she's like, whatever. And that's like, I even think that person would be incredibly driven.
Yeah.
Like, she would have to be incredibly driven. That's actually kind of the weird thing to me, is they play it like Peter Gallagher and Donna Murphy kind of say, like, well, you were the best where you were, but now you're here. But weirdly, they don't even seem like the best where they were. Zoe Saldana kind of does. But especially, her and the lead, you're like, why aren't you better?
Well, this was something I thought was really interesting, is that they actually wanted her to be even worse. And Nicholas Heitner was like pushing her in that moment when they're yelling at her about her feet. He was like, turn her out more, turn her out more. She's like, I would not have gotten into this if what my feet looked like. Like, it's like, the minutiae at this point between perfection and not quite good enough is so limited, right?
And keep in mind, this is high school. This isn't, you know, dancers, like something like Fame, although I think there's some maybe high school. This is, most of these dance films are people in their early 20s, they're young, youngish, but these are like 17-year-olds. These are people who, and this never shows in the film, but they would have had to be doing their studies as well, like go to math class with all the other dancers, go to chemistry, go to whatever high school thing you do, while then also doing this the insanity of trying to be good enough so that when you graduate from the school, you get snatched up by a dance company from somewhere in North America.
I do think the cleverness of having the workshop and the conceit of, like, this is what's going to get you a job, that you're going to be plucked from this, which is the reason why you want to go to the school, because you have this opportunity where everyone respects the quality of the dancers and you will then get work from there. But the fact that it ends with the dance number that it ends with, yes. Cam, I know you want to get into this.
Well, it's like, sigh. It's just... I don't know. Number one, it's just dumb to me to have a ballet movie be like... And to be fair, I'm not the biggest ballet guy in the world, but I've been to, like, you know, experimental ballets. I've sat at, like, La 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 Human Steps. I get it. And this is not that. So it's like they want to make Ethan Stiefel's character be this, like, forward-thinking...
Bad boy.
Ballet guy. The bad boy of ballet. I mean, of course, the most wonderful fact about this is there's this subplot of him sort of being the, like, arm candy of an older woman. And then there was a real-life scandal where he was the arm candy of an older woman. like a rich benefactor, he essentially was pimped out, and willing to do it. And it was, like, in the New York Times.
Cooper, how you been? Can I tear you away for a minute? There's a woman here whose husband just died, leaving her $200 million, and she adores you.
Excuse me. That was beautiful.
Let me introduce you.
Now, why does that feel wrong?
Oh, it's just a hello. It'll be great for the company.
Jonathan!
Steve!
Well, if it's good for the company. I mean, you know me. Team player.
Yeah, so they make... It's this conflict between him and Peter Gallagher.
Am I the only one who thinks it is wild that Peter Gallagher, who... Big Peter Gallagher fan, very attractive man. But the fact that he tells a 20-year-old, I got the girl, is like the weirdest thing to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd conflict, but I guess it's the kind of conflict that I guess you get. It's also kind of weird because, you know, you think of like... I guess I'm trying to think of like a dance star major domo, and I guess it's like Natalie Portman's husband, Benjamin Millepied. Like, I guess they're kind of like the hot older ballet guy. But anyway, it's weird because they have this fight, but then the thing he chooses is not really to do an experimental ballet. What he chooses to do is mix modern dance with ballet, which is like, well, that's not ballet, dude. And like, because Cooper also enjoys going to these Y classes where he gets to wear a headband and just enjoy dance, which like it totally clicks. It clicks, it clicks, it clicks. And then they just make this stupid ballet where he drives a motorcycle on stage, and it's supposed to be the toast of the town. And like, technically,
Michael Jackson,
again, they're
right?
Doing.
That
yeah,
was a
yeah,
weird
like,
Jamiroquai
dated reference.
Feel. I mean, the music throughout is a real chef's kiss of early 2000s. This is a fascinating movie because it's like right before 9/11 New York, so that's kind of fascinating. Sure. It's got like just banging Jamiroquai soundtrack, like
which okay, Napoleon yeah. Dynamite is totally a reference
yes.
to this, right? Like that's
probably,
or is it just
yes.
oh,
Hand Heat is
yeah.
just a great song. Okay,
yeah. And I mean, so it just kind of is interesting because you would think that this giant epic dance at the end, and Zoe Saldana's dance is kind of the dance that you would expect to be at the end.
It's
which
Swan
is like
Lake,
a very
right?
technically,
Am I crazy?
Yeah,
it's just Swan
Lake. It's yeah, yeah, but it's technically beautiful and proficient and whatever, and she kills it, and everyone's like, oh, so beautiful. Whereas this goofy ass
<It's so ridiculous.
laughs> tearing her dress off, and it's suddenly it's red,
which
is the real
had
one.
To do that. So many times.
Oh, I
and
can't imagine. To be fair, that is a
and...
fabulous effect. And yeah. I like that they had the costume designer being like, I'm so proud of that.
Yeah.
But
this
and, like,
film
again,
also won a choreography
amazing.
Award from the American Choreography
And it
Society.
Should. And like, I don't want to shit on the choreography because
no,
there's absolutely nothing wrong with what they're doing. And I think that they tried very hard to conceptualize this. And I think that the thing is real experimental ballet is probably pretty dull on film.
Yeah.
And you're also trying to make a movie that's a mass appeal. So I get it. But
I'm sorry,
yeah,
Ken. Have
it's
you
just
ever
so
seen
corny.
Wim Wenders' Pina?
No. Oh, I have. Yeah. Those were actually pretty cool.
I take
cool.
offense
and I, you know,
at experimental ballet is boring on film because I don't believe it.
Let me tell you, Wim Wenders knew what to do, which was make it 3D.
That's true.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't know. And I get like, I think the appeal of this movie is weirdly like not even in the dance and not any of this, but it's just kind of like a chill like hangout
yeah.
movie for girls.
It's
like,
a sleepover
it's a very,
movie.
It's an incredibly long movie that goes on forever, but you like the
it's
characters.
Too long.
They're nice to hang out with. The conflict, I mean, I guess the Susan May Pratt's eating disorder is maybe a little harrowing, but that's like the most harrowing conflict. And in the end, everybody gets what they want. They're all happy. Maybe not her mother. That's the only one that's
she's the real villainess of this film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
you get
you
like a
what?
Full Donna Murphy story arc and she's just hanging out in the background. I don't know.
But you know what? I am grateful for the fact that I'm watching a teen movie that is talking about, hey, so you devoted your entire life to something, but hey, guess what?
Yeah.
You don't want to do it and it's making you miserable. You can stop. That's okay.
It's maybe more interesting than Bring It On because like
yeah.
Bring It On never really plays with the idea of like, oh, perhaps I should not be a cheerleader at all.
Yeah.
Like perhaps this is a something that is rotten to its core and I shouldn't be involved. Where I guess Center Stage also exposes that perhaps this is rotten
this
to its
really
core.
This really spoke to me.
But they're
this,
like, we love
this
it.
This spoke to 15-year-old Alicia saying, I don't want to fucking do this anymore. I hate it
yeah.
with every ounce of my heart.
Oh, totally.
And that's okay. You can leave.
And I mean, I actually know a lot of people who... The interesting thing, it like got to this level of ballet and then took the door
yeah,
out
yeah.
and are happy with it. Because, yeah, we again, the other part of our school is we had an arm of the National Ballet School
Jesus.
That was like the pipeline to send you there when you were, you know, 16 through 18.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know anyone that continued on
I mean,
with it.
Yeah, the
eventually
attrition rate's
got to
be like 98%.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and
yeah.
even then your life expectancy as a ballet dancer is to like 30, maybe
sure.
32 if you're lucky. Like,
do you mean career?
Done.
Do you mean career or life?
Career, yeah. Yes, career.
You
that die. Is
like,
your life,
you
Alicia.
Die at 29.
Sasha Radetsky still alive, question mark?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at Ethan Stiefel, he looks like he's lost his mind.
Yeah, I couldn't believe. I mean, yeah, Google
that
photos
haircut?
Of that.
Google him. Google
he looks
him.
Like Monty
I mean,
Hellman, or not Monty Hellman.
Yeah.
He looks like Hal Ashby.
Yes, he does
Hal
look like
Ashby
Hal Ashby.
Were
I mean,
dancing while directing Harold and Maude. It would look like Ethan.
He looks
Stiefel.
Confident, and I'm sure he's got a great body. But yeah, that haircut is wild.
Yeah, I liked this. The one thing about the finale that really spoke to me is I think, and I could be wrong. I'd be curious if there's like listeners who are very into ballet as well. But there's a lot of references to the Red Shoes,
sure.
the Powell and Pressburger film starring Maura Shearer, who was a real Scottish ballerina, and Ludmila Chechorina, who is a French ballerina of Russian descent, which is a great example of a film from the 40s that actually shot real ballet. It didn't just like hire actresses to play ballerinas, but it's very much considered like one of the best I would say, I mean, how could it not be the best ballet film of all time? It just kind of is. But all that redness, even in the makeup, I mean, the makeup that Moira Shearer wears in the red shoes for the most insane dance finale, I think, in any film. It has very distinct eyeliner that the Amanda Shule character has little hints of. So I'm seeing a little bit of the red shoes. I'm also seeing a little bit of a film that I think is fascinating called White Nights, which is 1985.
Oh, yeah.
It's directed by Taylor Hackford. And it stars Mikhail Baryshnikov and Gregory Hines
and
Helen Mirren
actor.
And Isabella Rossellini. Like, it's
sure.
I would really encourage people to see it. It's like if Center Stage had espionage
spies,
and a plane crash and FBI agents, you would have, or should I say CI agents, you would have White Knights, which is, a film not many people talk about.
Mikhail Baryshnikov, good actor.
He's a great actor. And I actually think the Coop character is designed after Baryshnikov, specifically and generally
he's
in his costuming
look.
And his like leather jackets, but also specifically in White Knights, where he's this sort of renegade rebel ballet dancer.
Oh, sure. And he teams up with a tap dancer, which is exactly what Cooper would have loved.
Yes, exactly.
So as we exit the center stage, this is the end of season two. So let's just have a quick chat briefly. If there is like one film from the previous season that was like a surprise to you, or you're like the one that was like, this is the one people should see if you see nothing else. What do you guys think that movie was? Alicia, let's start with you.
The film that was most important to me, and I don't want to say it was surprising because I knew I was going to love this filmmaker, but I am reserved in recommending everyone see it, is Seven Beauties, the Lena Wertmüller.
Yeah.
I would say listen to the podcast potentially before diving into that film.
Sure.
But it's something that, you know, we did for the podcast with guest Emily Gagnier of Hollywood Suite, where I then like spent many months over the spring and summer just watching every Wertmüller I could get my hands on as a result of doing Seven Beauties for the podcast. And that was paired with The Passenger, which is also a real revelation. That would be mine.
Cam, how about you, my love?
I mean, the one that I'm constantly pushing and that is coming to Hollywood Suite in a couple of months when you hear this is Coolie High, which I think is... It's being reevaluated and brought back, and I think it's just such a good and important movie, and it's just fun. It's a fun film.
I can't wait for us to be in Hollywood Suite. And Carolyn Morissette was so great on that.
Yeah.
I wish I could have been on that episode. She was fantastic.
Yeah. And I mean, my dumb one is I love Cemetery Man,
yeah.
But I think it gets enough love in the horror community. But if you're not a horror person and you just love Rupert Everett,
Italy for the win. 3 out of 4 films were Italian.
Mm. That's right. I'm going to have to go with Love and Basketball as like a big, I'd never seen it before and I loved it so much. I went back and watched it twice and it was really awesome to talk to Rad about it because Rad is like very vocal and expressive and he was super stoked. So I feel like it was a good yelly episode of joy.
I haven't listened to that episode yet, but I'm imagining knowing Rad as well as I know him, he was probably sweating and gesticulating a lot on the Zoom.
Just a little.
He's always amazing.
And I'll say, Becky, if you haven't seen Beyond the Lights, if you can get past the Nate Parker of it at all, it's the other Gina Prince Bythewood romance. And it's quite charming.
I know what I'm doing this weekend. I'm also going to be prepping season 3 because season 3 is coming up very, very soon in the next few weeks. What are you guys looking forward to for that one?
I mean, I guess to reveal, it'll be coming in Shocktober, and we're Shocktobering it hard, including a lot of favorites for me, including one I've mentioned on the podcast before, What's the Matter with Helen, which is watch it, but don't look at the poster because they spoil the ending in the poster.
It's a psycho biddy film.
A classic weird thing.
Yes. I gotta say, man, that whole psycho bitty thing, I've been already going down a rabbit hole of research, being like,
this
is a genre I love.
Yeah,
to be paired with Who Slew Auntie Rue, which is a great title.
Yeah.
Which both have Shelley Winters in them, so I'm sure we'll get into her. She's an interesting human being.
And also, I will say that this is the first time, I'm always trying to get John Sayles stuff involved, and we're getting him for the first time with Alligator, which is a great script by him. I love his B-movie script.
Ugh, I'm so excited for that one. How about you, Alicia? What are you stoked for?
Mouse Hunt. 1997's Mouse Hunt is the film of the pandemic that really has carried me through. I knew it wasn't going to make the TV show. Like I was, yeah. I know I asked you to watch it, Becky, maybe, and I think maybe Emily, and it didn't happen. So,
I will say that
it's nice to keep it for the podcast because we'll get a full half hour of me just rambling about Mouse Hunt.
Yeah. I think that one of our years is 1997, and that's a pretty killer streak.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
All of those are just, I think it's just because it's our age. That was kind of a time, but it's like just a bunch of blockbusters and crazy movies that are fun to revisit.
It's also the first year that I felt like I was really watching adult movies, if you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just so much good stuff. There's so much good stuff. I'm really stoked for season 3. Thank you for putting it together with me, guys, because it's going to be a lot of fun. All right. So, Alicia, once again, thank you so much for your time in season 2. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Becky. If anyone has a bootleg copy of the pilot for LA Nights, the aforementioned, was that what it was called, Cam? LA Nights?
Oh, no, City of Angels.
Oh, shit, City of Angels.
Oh, you could probably just find it. There is a season of it.
Oh, it actually happened?
It happened.
It's just one season.
Yeah.
I'm going to go offline for about a week. No one contacted me.
Tell us how it is. Tell us what went wrong. Probably racism. I'm going to go ahead and say it's probably racism.
And Cam Maitland, thank you again, as always.
Thank you. I feel like I just need to now go watch Pina again and make up for my sins.
I will send you a curated list of experimental dance movies and you will watch every single one.
I'm good. As long as there's no motorcycles, I'm fine.
That's all you need. All right, listeners, that's just about everything for season 2. So you can join us again in a couple weeks for season 3, and we're going to have a very excellent Shocktober in 1971 to start. Man, oh man, I love 70s horror movies. They're just so weird. And if you haven't already, remember to hit that follow button on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on so that you'll know when season 3 drops. You'll get that notification. Once again, take care out there, and thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland, and featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.